Hello and welcome to Rewatchable, episode number 441. Today we are talking A Muppet Christmas Carol. So basically consider this our Rewatchable Holiday Spectacular. My name is Danielle and I will be your host today. And before I introduce my other co-hosts, I want to let you know how to get in contact with us because we miss talking to you. We've missed you over the last few months and we want you to get in contact with us. So please email us at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. Tweet at us at @re_watchable and join our Facebook group. We're on there as Rewatchables Rewinders. It still has pitch photos and stuff on it. So that's how you kind of know you're in the right place. As I said, I am not alone today. That would be very, very sad. So I have quite a few co-hosts here with me. I have Brittany, Natalie, Ariana, and Kendra. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hi.
It's so great to be back. It's so great to hear your voices again. And while I know your voices, it might be a while for other people who might have forgotten what you sound like. So let's jump in to our fun facts section right away. And we're going to do it a little bit differently this episode. Usually it's kind of a fun fact of whatever we have going on, but we wanted to theme it this time because we are doing a holiday spectacular. And so the theme for this fun fact section is throw out your favorite Christmas movie, episode, like TV episode or special. So anything that you love, or anything even that you would recommend other people to watch. And I want to kick this over to Ariana first, because this idea was hers. So Ariana, your fun fact or your fave Christmas thing.
So my favorite Christmas special would have to be Downton Abbey season 2, which ideally I feel like you should watch all of season 2, or at least the first or a couple of episodes before getting into the Christmas special. But I got so incredibly emotional watching it. I just feel like it has such a great payoff after so many ups and downs, and there's a lot of beautiful snow. It's just such a great feel good Christmas special.
That one, Ariana, was in the middle of the season. It wasn't like at the end of the year or something, was it? It was like a Christmas.
No, it was. It was the finale to season 2.
Oh, okay. They had a Christmas episode. Okay. And that's the one like where like.
That's the one.
Yeah.
That isn't sad.
Yeah. But it's not the one where he comes home from the war. Is it? Like,
no, but I know what you're talking about. That was in the middle of season 2.
But it's also at Christmas.
Yes, it is. It is like, also at Christmas.
But you're talking about the one like at the end. Yeah, okay. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, at the end. I do love that one. That one is really good. And the first time I watched it, because I watched them out of the way I watched Downton Abbey, it was the first time. It was during Christmas and PBS was doing like a, what's it called? I forgot how to talk now because I never
like a
do.
Binge or like a.
Yes, they were doing like a marathon. Thank you.
Talk you there.
They were doing a marathon and I caught like the last, I feel like we caught like the last couple, like when he's in the bed for the long period of time.
Yeah. And then he walks again. Yeah.
Yes. I'm trying to be as vague as possible,
yeah,
but that's not really helpful
love it,
here.
Love it. You don't even know who he is. People don't even know.
But I just remember I was watching with my mom and sister, and we just got so invested so incredibly quickly to Matthew and Mary. We were just like, oh my gosh, we have to know what happens. So then on Black Friday, we went and we bought the seasons 1 and 2 on DVD, and we binged them. And the Christmas special it's not a Christmas special, but the Christmas episode you're referring to, Natalie, because I knew that he got hurt. I thought he was going to show up hurt in that one. And so when he showed up not hurt, I was like, oh my gosh. And I started crying.
Yeah.
But I do love the real Christmas special. That one is just feel good.
I mean, that one's very feel good. And that's like rare for British Christmas specials because they're like famously depressing, like not just for this show, but like, and I've asked Leo about this many times because, you know, she's British. She lived in the UK till she was 18, like from birth. And she's like, yeah, in Britain, Christmas is sad. Like, it's not fun. Like, everyone takes it as, like, a really wistful, you know, even all of the ads for, like, department stores, like, where they do, like, a special Christmas ad are usually, like, super sad. And most Christmas specials of TV shows are, like, something painful, not, like, something fun. Like, that is, like, a thing. Like, Britain,
okay,
they find Christmas really depressing.
My complaint about the season 3 Christmas special is that it is sad, but not in a beautiful way. Like, the
it's shocking
episode where another person dies, that is sad in a beautiful way, and like you're left feeling it like you've cried, but it feels cathartic. Or like when Buffy's mom dies, like that feels cathartic, and this is just like
shock.
What just happened? What?
Yeah.
No.
They love to make people like messed up on Christmas. Like, it's British Christmas specials are nearly always sad. And like, it's like a shock when they're not. Like, whenever we do like a Call of Midwife, like, I love Call of Midwife, right? And they do Christmas specials every year. That's not my selection for this episode. But like, they're nearly always sad. And it's like, when one isn't sad, it's like, oh my God, thank God. Like, it's like you, there's an expectation that like you're going to sit down with your family on Christmas night and watch Doctor Who or Call the Midwife or something and be miserable. Like, that is what they do for Christmas. And it's quite interesting to me, I guess. It's weird and stressful, but yeah, it's like emotional attack on Christmas every year.
One final thing, and then I promise I'll stop talking about Downton Abbey.
Oh, no.
That my theory is that the season 3 Christmas special was filmed with the full intention of, like, let's still try and convince this man to stay. And that's why it's like that, because it's like, oh, if we can get him back, then we can just cut out the last 30 seconds.
He didn't.
Yes.
Yeah. I've just seen an article of 9 of the saddest and un-Christmassy Christmas specials ever made, and that episode is number 1 on the list, Ariana. Oh, not the one you picked, the other one that you mentioned, season 3.
Are they all British shows?
Oh, probably. Anyway, carry on.
All right, Natalie, since you've given us the ones that aren't your choice and all of the sad, depressing options, is your pick for your favorite movie or TV, is it also depressing?
It's so I picked the Schitt's Creek Christmas special. Full disclosure, my favorite Christmas movie is of all time is Home Alone 2, which we're not allowed to talk about now because of Donald Trump. So until I get the Canadian cut of that that's like edit him out, we're not gonna talk about that. So I picked Schitt's Creek Christmas special, which is before season 5, I think. So it aired as a one-off in between season 4 and season 5. And it's a really cute, very slightly wistful episode about the Roses celebrating Christmas in Schitt's Creek. And I really loved it, like, for many reasons, but especially for Johnny Rose, like Eugene Levy. It's the first episode of Schitt's Creek ever that had a flashback to the time when they were rich. Like, the show never, ever did that except for in this episode. And I found it, like, very moving because it actually really highlighted, like, how messed up the family was. Like, we never really, like, we see them, you know, start to grow closer and grow out of, like, their bad habits and all of that, but we never really get a realistic look at, like, why, like, what was so bad about them before. This episode shows, like, a flashback to their old holiday party, and it's, like, super messed up and super sad because Johnny isn't really messed up. Like, you can tell, like, in kind of subtle ways in this episode that Johnny kind of never took his wealth for granted, and that he was, even though he's like Jewish, was very like moved by these Christmas parties, and all he wanted was to like end the party with his like family together under the Christmas tree and like, you know, living in his little kind of happy land. But like everyone else is like messed up, like totally callous, genuinely not really caring about each other, like very drugged up. And like, yeah, so getting that flashback was like really cute to me, and kind of gave it a new perspective to the show that I really appreciated. And then the actual party in Schitt's Creek was, of course, like a ridiculous failure, but much more heartwarming than any of the like dream parties that Johnny tried to orchestrate these beautiful moments and was never able to because his family was so absent. So yeah, I don't know what I was expecting when they were going to do a Christmas special, but that was the episode that genuinely, I mean, I love all of the people in Schitt's Creek, but that episode made me feel so much for Johnny in a way that I hadn't expected. And I think using that vehicle of it being the only time it flashed back was like, they did a really good job with it. So yeah, that's my current fave in terms of both nice Christmas stuff. Also, I'm Jewish, or my remaining family is Jewish. And so our Christmas traditions are very like sentimental, secular in a similar way to his. But yeah, that was my favorite so far. I'm not sure if anyone else has any thoughts on it, but yeah, I found it really, really sweet. And again, like I like the tinge of sad, I've got to say. Like I don't mind the wistful sad in Christmas stuff. Like I appreciate Ariana's like issue with the shock value Downton Abbey, but like some of the British stuff is like so unbelievably sad, like that I can't deal. But this had a good level of like slight wistfulness in a heartfelt way.
Yeah, I think wistful sad almost emphasizes the happiness that comes after it. So yeah, I always think it's there. Brittany, what is your choice?
Shocking. I'm not going to pick a Hallmark movie, even though I watch them all year. But
that is shocking.
So I'm not going to pick a movie at all because I love Christmas movies so much that I don't think I would be able to narrow it down. But I think my favorite TV episode for Christmas is any of the Bob's Burgers, but in recent years, I just love Bob's Burgers holiday episodes so much. So I really love, there's one called We Wish You a Maily Christmas, and it's when Linda goes to work at the post office because the post office always needs extra help around the holidays, and she volunteers and she like tries to like make it fun, and the employees are just so grumpy or like aren't listening to her, and she plays a game, like she hides a creepy Santa around the thing, and like whoever finds it gets like a stale candy cane. And it's, she's just like humming along and just so happy, and she like goes on this mission because a guy got to the post office late, and so his package didn't make it on the truck, and so she felt bad that someone wasn't going to get a gift. And it's just like really wholesome, same along the same lines as Natalie. I think that the Bob's Burgers family is just like the purest family on TV, and they're just so cute, and I really love their holiday specials, especially the Thanksgiving ones. But that Christmas one just for some reason jumped out at me when this topic was thrown out. I love the West Wing holiday episodes as well, but the one that I like the most is severely depressing because it's a character working through his PTSD during the whole episode. So like he was involved
Merry
in the
Christmas.
Shooting, oh yeah. And, I just got to the, I'm just clicking through that list I mentioned of sad ones. Is that the 2000 special with Josh?
Yes, Noel. It's
that's on the list of the that I was just mentioning, the most depressing ones. Yeah. I just got to it as you said it.
Such a good episode, but it is like really depressing.
Yeah, it is. It, you know, obviously like shows air like stuff that doesn't actually air on Christmas Day. They're, you know, like airing like in the, you know, midwinter finale before Christmas break or whatever. And like those are like, okay, you can be depressing. The British ones that get me are the ones that like literally air on Christmas. Like it's the event that you sit down and watch on Christmas, and they're like so depressing. It's like, okay, you want to do this on your holiday, but I don't know if any American shows air stuff on Christmas night. Is that common? Like aside from like movies being programmed or something, like because regular TV isn't on over the holidays.
I don't think there's really like anything actually on TV on Christmas, like new or anything. Netflix has new stuff, but like that's recent.
Yeah, the channels basically know, or the networks, that's the word for it. The networks basically know that they're not going to get a ton of viewers. And like the Christmas specials aren't as much of a thing here as they are
I go to the movies every Christmas night, not this year, obviously, but that's like, so like Wonder Woman being released, like I probably would have gone to the theater to see Wonder Woman or something like that. So like last year I saw Little Women on Christmas Day. Like we would go to the
movies. Yeah, we go Christmas Day as well.
I used to always go on Boxing Day. Like it used to be that we didn't used to have cinemas open on Christmas. But it would always be like Lord of the Rings would come out on like the 26th on Boxing Day. So going on Boxing Day, like leaving my family's like, cause my family used to do Christmas up at a cousin's house that was like an hour out of Sydney. So like leaving to go into the city to see Lord of the Rings, like was a thing. But, I actually just saw our cinemas aren't so bad. Like our situation isn't so bad with COVID and cinemas are open. And I just saw that like a cinema, like that, it's this independent cinema across the way from us. It's airing on Christmas Day, like Fiddler on the Roof for like all the Jewish people not celebrating Christmas because it's in a we don't have a big Jewish community here, but this was in an area of Sydney that does have a slight Jewish population, and so that amused me greatly. But yeah, no, Britain is like a big Christmas is a big television night. You sit down and you watch like. You know, like used to be like Doctor Who, like that isn't on this year. I don't think they've run a season this year, but like, or like, yeah, Call the Midwife. This year they've got my new little favourite, All Creatures Great and Small, the James Herriot, like Yorkshire vet stories. They've got a Christmas special and that will probably be depressing too. So, yeah, it's just a weird thing. But, yeah, I wasn't sure if you guys aired Christmas specials on Christmas Day there. So, no.
No. No, just movie marathons of Christmas Vacation and A Christmas Story. All right, Kendra, I know you kind of created your own Christmas special this year, complete with gingerbread, but do you have a favorite TV or movie special?
I do. I am going to do a movie and kind of buck the trend.
Do it. Mm-hmm.
It's a more recent Christmas movie. It's The Night Before. Starring Seth Rogen. Natalie was my affection for him. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Anthony Mackie, Mindy Kaling, and Lizzie Kaplan. And it's not the funniest movie Seth Rogen's ever been in, but I do believe it's the funniest Seth Rogen has ever been in a movie. So all of his scenes make me laugh so much. And it is it's probably my only movie, like strict Christmas tradition, like every holiday season I need to watch The Night Before, and this year because it was so terrible it was like July, it was like, is it time to watch The Night Before yet?
Oh my god.
So it was like,
wow.
November 12th.
I forget that one exists.
Oh my god,
it's a good one though.
So good. There's like his wife I think is pregnant. Oh yeah. So anyway, the premise of the movie is that him and his friends Seth Rogen, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and Anthony Mackie have, like, every Christmas Eve, like, they go crazy. Like, they have this party. And so this is the last one that they're doing because they're, like, kind of moving on with their lives. Seth Rogen's wife is pregnant. So she, as, like, a last hurrah to him, gives him every possible drug for that night. So, like... So he's just like drug tripping the whole time. But then there's like a scene where he ends up having to go to Christmas Eve mass with her family and is so sick from the drugs that like at one point he's like, where's the barf bag? Like there's just like normally a barf bag in churches. It's so funny. But anyway, it's like, yes, it's like a funny, normal Seth Rogen movie, but also it's like, so friendship forward, like it's all about the three guys and like their relationship, and then also Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Lizzie Kaplan have like a romance thing, so like it's very heartfelt. Miley Cyrus has a cameo that is awesome. She sings Wrecking
What?
Ball. Yeah. Anyway, it's amazing. Next Christmas, or still this Christmas, there's time.
There's still time.
I definitely recommended this movie to a friend of mine recently whose taste it is like exactly. Kendra, you met Megan. Yes. Megan, her partner, Katrina, this is like exactly her taste in movies. And she didn't know, she was like, how did I miss this existing? And I'm like, Katrina, this is your movie. Like you need to. So I'm really excited to hear her review of it. So yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Yeah. Highly recommend it.
Oh, I need to revisit with that one. Thank you. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
I'm going to follow your movie trend. At first I wasn't, I was going to do a TV show, but I'm going to follow your movie trend. And Brittany, I'm not choosing a Hallmark movie, but I am choosing a Lifetime movie. My pick is The Spirit of Christmas. It is I don't know. If you've seen people tweeting about a Christmas movie with a sexy ghost, this is that one. And I love it so much. I love it so much. Okay, so the premise of this movie is basically this woman has to go and they're trying to sell this B&B, this inn, because like all the people died off. And so they need to sell it and they need to offload it, but they can't do that because it's haunted by a ghost of a man who like used to own it. And so she has to go there and like figure out how to sell it. And then she ends up trying to help the ghost figure out how he died and how he can move on. And like the ghost is a smoking hot 1920s bootlegger looking dude. And he's got like a really nice 3-piece suit and he's just so handsome. And so basically the entire movie, you are shipping this woman and this ghost. And I watched it again today. I try to watch it once a year since I discovered it a few years ago. I yell at the TV like when
they Googled kiss, it.
I scream. It's so good.
He's quite cute.
He is very, very, very handsome.
This is wild.
Yeah. Ariana says it's on Hulu. It's also on Amazon Prime too. That's how I watched it today.
I didn't know they put like Lifetime or Hallmark movies on like
platforms. I didn't either. But I discovered this one actually because it was on Netflix, I think 2 years ago or so. That's where I first saw it. Two or three.
Wild. Okay. It sounds insane.
Yeah. So if you want a sexy ghost Christmas story.
Does it have like a frustrating twist?
I don't know if it's a frustrating twist, but I mean, there's drama in there. And the ghost is definitely much better looking than the ghost in any of the ghosts in A Muppet's Christmas Carol. So you have that to look forward to.
Does it have a happy ending? Because I can't do sad Christmas movies right now.
Yes, it is not a sad Christmas movie.
It doesn't turn out that he's like her great-grandfather or something stupid.
Okay. What?
No, that's a great question. No, it does not. It has a happy ending. This movie actually, if anybody here or anybody listening listens to How Did This Get Made, the Paul Scheer podcast where they go through all the terrible movies, they actually did an episode on this once. I think it was last year that they did it because it's bonkers. There is the magic in it doesn't make a ton of sense, but you just go with it. Like it's not enough to make it unenjoyable, but there's definitely questions that you might have that it'll never answer. But I love it so much and I may or may not watch it again tomorrow because why not? That's my pick is The Spirit of Christmas. Thank you for hearing me out on that one. And so from one spirit to another and another and another, I guess, let's jump into our main discussion for today. And that is A Muppet Christmas Carol. Now, we had quite a few movies that we had thrown out that we were trying to whittle down our list from on what we would record on today. And this was one, I think, that we had probably the most general interest within this group. And then also Brittany had put up a poll on Twitter and there was quite a lot of interest there. So we decided to go with A Muppet Christmas Carol. And I'm really wanting Brittany to jump in a lot on this episode because she is definitely our Muppet expert. So you will be hearing a lot from her on all of this. But before we get into any of the discussion, here is a quick recap for those of you who may not have seen it in a while or who just enjoy recaps. And so in this movie, miserly Michael Caine is visited by three puppet ghosts in order to learn the true meaning of Christmas and, by extension, save his soul. In the past, he's forced to reconsider the things that have shaped his experience. In the present, he learns exactly what others think of him, the good and the bad, as well as how others think of Christmas. And in the future, he did. In the end, Scrooge takes his lesson to heart and embraces not only Christmas, but love in general and all that other good shit, gets a scarf, and adopts a disabled frog.
Sorry.
I make a rule of not reading these beforehand just because it's just, I like rolling with it. So we're going to roll with that recap. Thanks so much for that. So let's break it down. First of all, I kind of want to break down the super fan and newbie groups here because we very much have those for this movie. In terms of super fans, we have myself. I grew up on this movie, have the VHS probably still, and very obviously Brittany, who is a lover of all things Muppets. And then we have Natalie, Ariana, and Kendra as our newbies, or as people who believe they are newbies because they didn't recognize this movie while watching it. And so I want to start with Brittany. I want to start with the super fans first. Brittany, how many times have you seen this movie, or is it impossible to count?
Well, I've seen it 3 times this year already. So I think
3 times this year.
Well, because when like the holidays, like it started like around Thanksgiving, I was like, oh, Disney Plus has some Muppet Christmas Carol. I guess I'll watch it now. And then I watched it. And then I watched it like a week ago with a friend because she was like, I think I'm going to put on the Muppet Christmas Carol tonight. And I'm like, you know what? Sounds good. And then I watched it again today for the podcast. So 3 times this year alone, I really love it. I've probably seen the 12-minute making of documentary 100,000 times.
You should have making of documentary. Oh, I want to link to that after this, please. Yeah.
You always, always Google Muppets behind the scenes whenever you're doing anything.
I don't know.
Actually, Muppet bloopers is better, but Muppet behind the scenes.
I have seen those.
Yeah, Muppet behind the scenes is very good. Yeah, I've seen this many times. I don't know. I think we actually have like 2 copies of the VHS. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but we do. We have like little figurines on the tree. And so, yeah, it's very well beloved in my household and in my life.
Why is your family like that. So into Muppets?
My dad grew up watching the Muppets. And then when he had kids, he was like, my children are going to watch everything that I watched. And so we watched like the Muppets, the Muppet movie, all of the Muppet movies, but like mainly the original one. Like we weren't introduced to like Treasure Island until, well, it came out when I was 6, but like even after when it came out, my dad was like, pump the brakes. So we're not going to introduce new Muppet material into this household.
You're purists.
Yeah, I don't think I saw the Muppet Treasure Island until I was like 14, even though it came out when I was 6. But yeah, so Muppet Christmas Carol was approved. I was 2 years old, so he had plenty of time to watch it before it actually seeped into my brain. And it was made after, you know, Jim had died, so it was a little weird. But Muppets were just a thing in his life, and so they became a thing in our life. This also includes like the man who like made us watch Rocky Horror when we were way too young to watch Rocky Horror because it's his all-time like favorite movie, like that, Young Frankenstein. Like,
I want to meet your dad.
Like, yeah, he's like kind of cool. So I'll give him that. So like a lot of my taste comes from him. So Muppets were just, that's what he grew up on. That's what I
grew up on. I was definitely exposed to them existing in pop culture and like the crossover ones on Sesame Street, but yeah, not like you. So
we watched, the Fraggles. Like we watched all sorts of like, he loves the artistry of like puppeteering.
Why haven't you taken Leo to hang out with him when we come to visit you?
You know, like the stop motion, like Christmas classics are more of his favorite like type of things, like anything that has like that kind of like feel to it. He always loved. So the Muppets just fit right in.
I love that. I love that so much. Yeah. I am not nearly to your super fan level, but I had, or probably still have, the VHS, watched it frequently. I have been bothering my roommate all year, or well, all season, I guess, this year, to watch the Muppet Christmas Carol, because every night after work, we'll both log off, eat dinner, and then we'll look at each other and be like, what are we going to watch tonight? And always enlisting the Christmas movies we haven't seen yet, I put Muppet Christmas Carol first, and she never chose that one, or like we never chose that one. So I have only seen it once this Christmas season so far. But again, there's still time. All right. So that is our super fan kind of experience with this movie. Newbies, how much about this movie, or just like in general, were you aware of going in? Did you have any expectations or anything like that?
I mean, I expected them to tell a Christmas Carol.
Sure.
Which they did.
Hey, that's good. So it met that expectation.
Yeah. I think I was surprised Michael Caine was in it. I think I thought it would be a Muppet.
I knew Michael Caine was in it, I conceptually. Like, if you'd pushed me to be like, who, I knew the Scrooge was a human, and I was I'm pretty sure I knew it was Michael Caine. Yeah, I'd heard it was faithful to the original story as far as it could be with Muppets, like that it was genuinely pretty accurate, like not like, you know, aside from like the humor and all of that, and that it was like, yeah, we, you know, and that people like the only Christmas Carol that matters is a Muppet Christmas Carol, and both because they find literature boring or because they, you know, don't want to watch like a Victorian period drama, or just because they like the Muppets, but also because it is a genuinely accurate telling of the story while also enjoying the stylings of the Muppets. And I think that became true. Like, I don't know. I don't have like the major hype. My main knowledge is that, like, I have a friend, again, it's Megan, Brittany and Kendra, who is like, Muppet Treasure Island is like her family's favorite movie of all time. And so they're all always like, screw A Christmas Carol, Muppet Treasure Island. Like, they're really like Muppet Treasure Island and nothing else. And so, which she commented on the poll, as Brittany may have seen. So that was my main experience, really. Yeah, I don't know why I never saw it. Perhaps it was on near me as a child, but I definitely was watching it with no clear memory of it either. So, yeah, that's it, I guess. It was, yeah, like I haven't had like a Muppet, like religious Muppet experience like Brittany. So I was just like, yeah, I guess that is a thing. And it was. Well, I think Kendra's story was the best
story of her is expectation. I want to get to that right now. Kendra, what were your expectations of A Muppet Christmas Carol?
Well, I am, unlike Natalie, quite familiar with the Muppets, so much so that I just assumed that I had seen this movie, because I did see another Muppet Christmas movie, which I guess was the Muppet Family Christmas Special. Brittany can correct me on that if that's not correct.
Yeah, which is, like, so weird, because anyone I've ever spoken to about that is like, where did you dig that up? That's not kidding. And when Kendra was like, I was thinking of the Muppet Family Christmas Special, I was like, that is so weird. No one ever knows what I'm talking about with this movie.
I saw that one for the first time, I think, last year. Didn't know it existed.
Okay. I feel like that was on TV all the time. And I don't know, I guess I just never got this one, because I thought I had seen it. And then I was trying to place who Scrooge was, and I couldn't like put any of the Muppets in that. And then apparently it's Michael Caine. So I had no idea. Definitely hadn't seen it. Weirdly, the only thing I did know about this movie was all of the songs, because I guess they had just shown up on like Spotify Christmas playlists that I had been listening to, because I sang all of those word for word as I was going through the movie.
Oh, and really?
Definitely had not seen it. Yeah.
Oh, I love this.
Especially the when something feels like love, it feels like Christmas, that one.
Yeah.
I feel like once I watched it, one song stood out as really familiar to me. I can't remember which one now, to be honest, but like one of them was like, I was like, I might know this, but the rest, nah. So yeah, you know, I wasn't expecting there to be songs, full stop. I'll say that, actually. I didn't know there was going to be songs.
So. Okay, so you didn't know it was going to be a musical. Okay.
That's correct. I know there's a point about that later, but I'll just say that now. I did not expect songs, so.
Nice surprise. All right, well, we will get there. So, Ariana, I want to go back to your original point in terms of your expectation of it, in that it told A Christmas Carol, which is good. I guess the question for the group is this, in your opinion, a good or like effective retelling of the tale? I know, Natalie, you mentioned that you've heard in circles that this is probably the most faithful or one of the best ones. But I was wondering, just in general, if the group thought it was a good one to watch. And if you had seen any others to compare it to. Like, I think this one for the longest time was the only version of the story I've ever read or heard or anything like that. Like, I haven't even read, I think, the original one.
I feel my strongest comparison is like the Mickey Mouse Christmas Carol, where Scrooge McDuck is Scrooge.
Makes sense.
But I feel like this is a really great adaptation. I was surprised by like how like good it was for children. Like, it does a really good job. Like, I was surprised it went so dark in the places it went dark, but it also never feels like, it feels like something I could let my kids watch. Like the stuff with like, is it Jacob Marley? Is that his?
Yeah.
Yeah. That stuff is so like, as an adult watching it, you're like, this is horrifying. But I can also see myself as a kid, not because they're like dancing and happy, like not fully understanding what's going on.
Kids self-regulate about dark stuff. Like, there's a lot of dark stuff in children's stuff that is like, as an adult, you're like, wow, the implications of that are horrifying. But kids do not like understand that at the time. So,
and I think you touched on a great thing, Ariana, in that this movie doesn't ever talk down to kids, but it's also very enjoyable for non-kids, for adults. Like, there's stuff in it for both. Like, there are different layers to it. And I really enjoy the fact that, like, I loved this as a kid. I thought it was hilarious. Rizzo kept me laughing when I was a kid. And also now, having watched it again yesterday, Rizzo still kept me laughing. And there was a ton in there that I hadn't noticed until I was an adult. And I like that it works on both levels.
I think it's like, it really comes down to Kane and how he like really just... He says it in an interview. He's like, I walked on set as if I was working with Shakespearean actors, and that's how I played the role. And so it's like, yes, I'm looking at a stuffed frog, but like, it's not like I am going to give this like the highest level of a performance. And I think that that just grounds the whole thing. So like, it doesn't get away from like, you're grounded in Scrooge's story, even though there's literal chaos going on around him. Like,
yeah.
I think they said that in the documentary, there's 280 puppets on that set. And so, they're singing grapes telling you about Scrooge, but then like, you're watching Scrooge and you're like, oh, I really get that this man is like a lot going on and he's about to go on a journey, but you're not distracted by the Muppets. So I think that it's just like, I think that balance is very good.
That's some like Muppet acting related. That is like just what you said that he said. That's like so interesting and makes so much sense, because it's also like, in terms of like the Henson world, what they said about Mark Hamill and Yoda, like the only reason Yoda works in the original trilogy is because Mark played it straight. Like, because he wasn't like, oh my God, it's a puppet. Like, he made it real. His emotional attachment here, because he's, and that actually helped, because Mark Hamill is like super into puppets and special and physical special effects. He, from a child, he takes that super seriously. But what you just said just really resonated, because like, I'm like, oh yeah, I get it. Like, I get why Michael Caine was like so good. It's because he like took it seriously, like regardless of the fact it was puppets, like, and it makes a difference. Like, you know, you'd be able to tell if like someone was like not really treating it authentically, I guess.
Yeah. And he says, he's like, I never like cracked a smile or like did like, you know, played off the fact that like this puppet's doing something weird. It's just like, you play it as if you're playing it as a character. And then a lot of people also say like the, you know, when you have like, even like people who go to like guest on Sesame Street, it's like, when you're there and you see Kermit, you don't even look at the puppeteer. because you're like, oh my God, Kermit is talking to me. And I think that that's like, it's such a Muppet thing. And it's one of my favorite things is that like the performers, yes, they deserve all the credit in the world, but they're not even listed in the opening credits. Like it's like Kermit the Frog as Bob Cratchit. Like, you know, going into any Muppet movie, you are seeing the stars that you are seeing are the Muppets. Like Gonzo is Gonzo. It's like, that's who it is. Like Fozzie's Fozzie. Like, you don't see Frank Oz's name as Fozzie until the end credits where it's like Muppet performers. Like, and it's in small font. Like, it's not even like big. So I feel like when you go to, well, at least when I go to see a Muppet movie, I'm like, I'm there to see the characters. And then like, no, like you're able to shut it off. But the filming of this is also like so cool. Like if you watch the behind the scenes thing, like Michael Caine, this will be my first fun fact. Michael Caine, when he's walking in like the streets and stuff, he's walking on like platforms and all of the Muppets.
Right. It's elevated so that they can be crouched below.
So it's like so funny because like all like they, all the Muppets like are held above their heads. So like they're standing and or crouching, but they have the Muppets over their heads. And then they like, usually what they'll do is like, especially with like Gonzo and Rizzo, when they're like just filming their scenes, like they are watching on monitors, like what their actions are doing because the Muppets are over their heads.
Yeah. There is a couple of scenes where you see like a full body of the Muppet, like Kermit running and stuff, which is like the special effects on that are slightly dodgy because it was like quite a while ago, but.
Yeah. Well, you can like see the track running underneath him. So like that's. Yeah. Still, it took 10 puppeteers to make that work. So, So they have like people doing the legs and then the performer, and then like Robin's there too. So, well, Robin playing.
Tiny Tim. Yeah.
So, like, they have, you know, they, if you watch like the background, so like they're, he's walking on like a single track.
And yeah, so, like a treadmill.
Yeah. So, like, you see the snow like just falling off behind him.
Yep, I saw that specifically this time around. I know exactly what scene you're talking about. I was watching the snow in that one.
Anytime I have to like film Kermit's legs, I'm so uncomfortable. Like he rides a bike in the original Muppet movie and it's like freaks me out.
Okay. Let's go back to Michael Caine, actually. I'm glad that you kind of started us down this road because I think this was my first introduction to Michael Caine, and I didn't realize it obviously until much later in life. I think when we were planning for this movie, I think someone in this group said that they couldn't imagine Michael Caine as a villain. Was that someone in this group? I can't remember. And if so, like how do we think he played Scrooge? Like for me, he is my Scrooge. But again, I haven't experienced any other version. Yeah, go ahead.
That question comes down to whether you think Scrooge is a villain. And I don't think he is. So, yes, I don't know. I think he was, I think that sort of comes down to like, it certainly wasn't my first experience of Michael Caine. Though my friend said that, again, like Treasure Island was their first introduction to Tim Curry, which is a wild. Yeah. Again, mine might have been Rocky Horror. I'm not sure. So that's like, I'm just picturing Britney's childhood of those fluctuating between.
A lot. There was a lot going on with Tim Curry in my early childhood.
I think that he did Scrooge like pretty, you know, pretty sympathetically. But I think it's kind of like I think the question about what you think of Caine's performance comes down to like what you think of Scrooge as a character, like whether you have immediately written him off or whether you're like what you think like his driver is to make him the way he is when the story starts. I know that's a bit deep, but I thought he was really good. Like I think there's a lot of actors that have played Scrooge, and you know, I'm now kind of interested in like comparing some, I guess. Like Patrick Stewart's played Scrooge in an adaptation, and I know there's a filmed production of the Jack Thorne, the TV and playwright. He wrote a stage version of Christmas Carol that's gonna have it's been done a few times, but this year they're doing it on like filmed stage because pandemic, with Andrew Lincoln from Love Actually and The Walking Dead as Scrooge. I feel like he'd be like a bit weird, but maybe it's good. I don't know. And then like heaps of people have played him, but I mean, I thought he was good and like very, you know, very sympathetic quite quickly, which I think is like the point of the story. Like if you can't turn around on being sympathetic for him, then you're not gonna follow the story. So
yeah, I think there are moments, for instance, when he's first scared at his front door where you see
the
facade kind of crack. And I think Michael Caine is really good at emoting that.
I think he plays the fear element well because like he's not really tapped into what's going on. He's like scared most of the time. And then like, you know, you get those like surges of joy until he realizes like, you know, where he is in his life and like what's actually happening. So like when he goes back to the past, like he's like terrified, but then like he like gets like these like, you know, memory floods of memories. And then like, I think the past is like, we'll get to it, but that's my favorite part of the whole thing. But the, you know, it's just, I think Caine is so good in like playing the different emotions throughout the experience that like you do as an audience, like member, you like waver with him. You're like, oh, I see like where you're cracking, or oh, I see like where you've put up this wall. And I think he's just really good at showing that instead of us having to be told this is what's going on, even if it's a kid's adaptation.
Yeah, because you don't get like a full explainer. You don't get, there's a lot that you have to judge on the emotion and like, and work out like, why would he have done that? Or like, what was his drive there? Because they're not like, there's no point where he's like, I did this because of this. Like I was, like I put a bit of detail at the end about the Dickens thrust of this, which is basically the fear of poverty. Like that Scrooge is a miser because of a fear of poverty that Dickens experienced due to going from being like upper middle class to deep poverty as a child because his father got into debt and everyone went to debtor's prison except for him as a 12-year-old child or something, and he had to go into the workhouse and like work off the family's debt. So like to Dickens that happened. And so, you know, I can't like see Scrooge without assuming that like his circumstance where we open the story is based in that kind of like fear, like that people have of like, you know, fear of not just like I'm greedy, but like when he goes upstairs and he doesn't turn the lights on, for example, like the lamps, that it's like he's like preserving wealth because of some sort of terror, basically. But the story doesn't actually tell you that. So like, I guess it's kind of like what you assume like his drive is about whether his emotions make sense. I don't know
with the light thing, like when he goes upstairs, you know, he's not eating like a full 5-course meal with 8 servants. He's living by himself and eating bread and cheese for dinner. Like sure, it's more than other people are having, but he's like not lavish.
Yeah.
He's one good dressing coat. Like that's it.
Yeah. He's not, hoarding. I mean, he might be hoarding wealth, but he's not like, yeah, he's not doing it to have stuff. He's doing it like because the fact that he's not letting himself have anything like kind of is a sign to me of fear, like fear of losing money and fear of being in poverty. But then obviously he's really like gross about like poor people and society and stuff as well, which again is another Dickens social commentary thing, which I'll talk about later.
And I think it's in kind of thinking about that, I think it's also extra interesting the way that we become sympathetic to him pretty quickly, because if it was Michael Caine as Scrooge with a bunch of human actors, I think his terribleness towards the poor and like everyone else around him wouldn't be nearly as affecting, I think, as his terribleness to these like rabbits. Adorable puppets and like just like cute creatures. And so it almost makes him feel that much worse of a person because he's terrible to these beloved characters, but also like you said, rabbits. And so the way that they're able to balance that with the fear that we see in the I guess instability, I think it's a really good balance.
I mean, I don't know about that. Like I see what you mean, but I also feel like the puppet, like because it is Muppets and because it's sort of played as not a joke, but like we're in a situation of like heightened comedy because it's the Muppets. If you said to someone, if you're looking at like a sickly child, like if you're really honing in like with realistic makeup and Victorian sort and all of that on a sickly disabled child, and your villain is saying, like, he better die and decrease the surplus population. That's, like, to me, like, more hard-hitting than him saying it about a frog. Because it's kind of not played as a joke. It wouldn't be played, like, with a twist of a joke. But, sorry, go on, Ariana.
I'm a little, maybe it's just because of the year we've had, but yeah. I have to be honest, I did not find him sympathetic. And mm-hmm. even, I mean, really, I was just like watching him. What I kept thinking about is like, I was reminded of currently like in Congress, I was thinking about all of like the Republicans
getting the vaccine
that I know go home and watch like A Wonderful Life or A Christmas Carol for Christmas and genuinely, or I don't know, maybe they are evil villains, but like genuinely can't see that they are Scrooge. And like, mm-hmm. especially considering the year we've had and like watching how many people are suffering and we're like fighting over $300 and it's like mm-hmm. ridiculous. It's so, I feel like I have so little patience for rich people right now.
No, that's a great point.
Who can't seem to have empathy for others.
Yeah, I guess to that, like to kind of validate that, or like not that it's not valid, but like I guess that you could twist the messaging of the movie to being like, hey, like feel sorry for mean rich people. You don't know what they've been through to get their wealth. I mean, obviously the takeaway is not that, because he like gets threatened with like damnation for acting the way that he does, which is, you know, good. It, you know, there is a level of sympathy offered to like how he got to be the way that he got. And I guess you're saying like you're not comfortable with that or just didn't work for you.
I guess I didn't really pay attention to that because at a certain point I just don't care.
Okay.
No, what made him get that way. And it's also like a little bit frustrating that it took literally him seeing, like, yes, he is to some extent changed because he's doing it out of the goodness of his heart, because this is a children's movie. And so yeah. I feel like we see that he's changed as a person, but like, just by the mechanics of the story, like he didn't really change because he's like, oh, what I was doing was wrong. Like he's changing because he's scared of going to hell. Like that's why he effectively changed. And I'm like, I don't know. Do we have to tell everyone they're
going to
be
Mike Pence? They're going to yes. go to hell.
Yeah. Like, do we have to have some ghosts visit every?
I mean, I wish we could.
Person in this country. But yeah. But he is like, he does do a lovely job. I am with him there at the end. I'm glad that he's, I guess I'm more, I mean, I was more glad for like Kermit, but I am glad that like he's had this change of heart.
Yeah. I think it's like meant to be about like someone like losing their way. And like, it kind of almost reminds me of like how like after World War II, there was like a lot of, you know, old women who for the rest of their life were like, had like fear of scarcity, even when the fear of scarcity, like they had enough money to go like buy another tin of tomatoes or whatever. But like that kind of like rationing fear forever is kind of what it reminds me of, like how it was played. But that being said, like I'm
projecting like some of that Dickens context onto it as well, whereas this actual movie, the text of this actual movie does not spell that out. So yeah. I do get what you mean. And like one of the points that I wrote down actually in my notes, my personal notes, was like, why him? Like, why this guy? Like, why, who decided he deserved to be saved? Was it like for his own sake or like for the sake of like his workers? Because like another, you know, like why, like narratively, was he chosen to be saved, basically? And I guess like in the text, there's not really an answer to that. But again, like Dickens had this like this is like a quite like an angry story. Like Dickens had like, again, like because of his own experiences, like he had like a kind of like a social outrage to like, because he did rise back up to being like successful middle class, and he like had like a pretty severe like aggression about how like general society was like, you know, looked past a beggar, or like, you know, basically like, yeah, the disparity of poverty in the Victorian times was very severe, and he was like someone, I don't know how much money he put into it, but he had like a personal outrage about like the dehumanization of poor people. And that was also a really big influence on this, like in how they, you know, what we see Scrooge saying, like his most evil and stuff like that. So I almost think it's like Dickens wanting to like take all of those people, kind of like what you said, like he almost like he is kind of where you are, Ariana, and which is a valid place to be, and be like, I want to do this to Mike Pence and Jeff Bezos and stuff, but I don't have the power to do that, so I'm going to do it in this story. And I actually think that that was a big part of, from what I know about the writing of this book, that was a big part of his drive in doing it. It was kind of meant to tell other people in society at the time not to be like that. So that like that was like one of the aims of it, or the motivators of it. So in the story, totally fair to not have patience for anyone behaving like that at the time, but it was meant to be somewhat of a moral lesson for the readers, which I'm not sure if that like changes anyone's feelings or whatever, but that was like, yeah, there's a lot of anger in this story.
Yeah, and I get that. I think I was, because I've seen this so many times, I didn't see it, or I didn't watch it with the current context around it. But when Ariana, you started talking, you kind of reminded me of, it's almost like Scrooge is telling the poor people how they should live their life, and like how they, if they don't live it how he thinks they should, like they're a waste of time, like they're not saving enough money, or being wasteful. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like the asking people to settle for $600 because $600 is a good, helpful amount of money to people who don't understand what is actually needed. So I think, Ariana, the context that you're bringing here, that you brought up, I think that is really interesting. And I want to keep following that as we go through the different ghosts and the different time frames of Scrooge's life, starting with the ghost of Christmas past and the creepy child ghost who comes and visits Scrooge. The ghost of Christmas past basically takes Scrooge to two places in his life, and that is the school where we kind of see him grow up a little bit, and his first employer. What did we think of Brittany? Actually, I remember you saying that the Ghost of Christmas Past and this whole section was your favorite part. Why is this your favorite part, or your favorite time frame?
I think I just like watching Scrooge recognize like exciting things from his past. You know, I like people looking back on fond memories, and then it's just it's a little lighthearted and nostalgic. And of course, Animal has to play the triangle very peacefully, which is always a fun time. And yeah, I really like this whole journey through these little vignettes, and just seeing, you know, where he came from and like how he worked with a pretty generous employer. And then, you know, there's just like a lot to fill in about his story. But I really like just the memories specifically that they chose, and just really getting a lot of Muppet involvement through these mm-hmm. scenes as well. And the creepy ghost is actually a puppet, believe it or not. It's not CGI.
I mean,
CGI.
Yeah,
it's,
I believe it.
It's not 1992 CGI, which I thought for a very long time.
Oh, yeah.
I also thought it was CGI, Brittany, so that's a great fun fact.
I could tell it was a puppet, but I assume there was some CGI layering over it to make glow and stuff.
They filmed the puppet in baby oil. Like the actual puppeteer went into like oil, and then they turned out that was too expensive, so then they filled it with water. But the puppet, like to get that like ethereal thing, there's some like obviously visual effects.
You're talking about like the floating dress.
Yeah, yeah.
That's so, like, practical?
Yeah, that was all filmed underwater.
Oh my god.
Yeah. And then my favorite thing from like the little like 12-minute documentary is they show like Michael Caine flying, and they're like, and we have everyone wear green, and then anything that's green we remove because it's a green screen. And I'm like, wow, really excited for green screen technology in 1992.
Like, but really, his flying was also pretty bad. Yeah,
they're like really pumped. He's like, he's literally like, you know, obviously everyone's seen a green screen, but like he's like on like a crane that's like fully green, and he's like,
yeah, laying, he's on like, a wire, right?
Yeah, like he's not wild, even like, really, like so he's like maybe like 6 inches off the ground.
Oh, okay.
Like it's like so funny, and he's just like by himself, like woo. But yeah, they were very excited about green screen technology. They said they were filming in the computer age, so watch out.
Wow.
Yeah. Stuff that the Muppets usually don't use. They're very practical beings. So this was huge for them.
I love that. Thank you for that nugget. There's a point in the doc here that I think, again, going back to what Ariana was saying, sticks out to me a little bit more, is I don't know if we really get a good idea of why Scrooge is kind of a penny pincher to begin with. Like why he starts the way he does. Like we see him, he's isolated. He doesn't go home. He doesn't seem to connect with other people, but we never get an idea as to why. And so the kind of basis for how he becomes the person he does when he is surrounded by good people, I think is a little questionable now that I'm thinking about it. And again, now that I'm thinking about it in the context of what Ariana was saying earlier, I didn't know, Ariana, Kendra, if you had any thoughts about where he starts and if that's an effective, I guess, baseline for where the story goes.
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. I don't think I really got that because I think it's just such an iconic story that you kind of put all of your preconceived notions and like the things you know about it on each adaptation you see. So my assumption definitely was that he wasn't able to go home for Christmas because that's what I had seen in other adaptations. But I guess that wasn't clear in this one. And I feel like if that's not clear and your assumption is that he just wants to stay at school for the holidays,
yeah,
that makes him a lot less sympathetic.
Yeah, I agree. Because you're kind of like projecting like, oh, Harry Potter doesn't have like a home to go to and everyone else has got a... You know what I mean? Like projecting that like everyone else has got a family to go to, but like, you know, stuff's depressing for him. So, you know, he's going to make the best of it and stay at school. Whereas if that's absolutely not true and he's rejecting warmth to be like self-driven.
Right. That's
why like it's just like you're a sociopath or whatever. Like, so yeah, I get what you mean. Like my vibe was very much kind of like, yeah, like that he's like making out like it's what he wants, but because it's something he can't have for whatever reason, but that is total projection. So I think it's sort of good to acknowledge that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. And I think I always thought that maybe his parents were dead or something.
Yeah.
Or like he has no family, but he has to have had some sort of family because he has a nephew.
He has a sister, and in the book, one of the parts that's like cropped down from this adaptation is like one of the Ghosts of Christmas Past is the scenes is to do with the sister. So I guess they just didn't like shove every single beat in the movie. But like, yeah, he has a sister. Maybe they were both. You know, maybe he was a scholarship student, she was a maid, and they were both poor or something. But again, like total projection.
Yeah, my Scrooge is Fred Flintstone, because the only version of this I had seen as a child was the Flintstones Christmas Carol. And in that's that amazing. One.
Oh, that one is so good. I had not thought about that version for the longest time until
I've seen that 200 times. And in that one, they do a really good job of like, his sister comes to the school one Christmas and it's like, Dad decided that you can come home this year. So like that one, he's like, he's not allowed to come home. And I think that
Maybe he's forced, like maybe, you know, you've got to earn our keep, you're the future of this family or like right. something like that. Wow. Miserable. Anyway.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I mentioned that because like he goes and his first job is with Fozzie Bear. Fezziwig, and everything is so joyous and he's very different from everyone around him. And then when we think he might get better because maybe Belle will be a good influence, he doesn't, and he kind of falls back into his ways. I don't know. I like the past as well. I think I like the older part of the past. I guess the more recent past, because I like all of the stuff with Belle, including the cut scene, which we will get to kind of towards the end. But I think I just like seeing all of that happiness and, like Brittany said, all of that nostalgia.
Also, Sam the Eagle having to be reminded that he's playing a bird.
Oh,
that I didn't get that until so yesterday.
Funny. Like, yeah, that was great.
I was like surprisingly proud of her. Like I remember as a kid being very sad whenever the girl would leave and like wishing that she would come back and like get married at the end of this movie. But I was just watching now as an adult watching it. Mm. I was like, good for you for like making the right choice for you and leaving. And you probably went and had a great life and met another nice man and had a family, and it's okay. You probably had a nice life because you know how to make decisions for yourself.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely one of those moments of like him, you know, you can believe his drive was motivated for her or not. Like, you know, like I am concerned that I don't have enough to set up a life for us and I'm going to prioritize that. But her being like, yeah, I don't care about that as much as actually some, you know, quality time and emotions and stuff. And like, you know, that's a story that often happens in love stories, isn't it? Like that whole disconnect.
Yeah, wanting to be the provider and not feeling
like and then like, you know, the person being like, actually, like you being so focused on that is like ruining like good feelings between us. So
there's a really great Hallmark movie that involves time travel that came out this year that like focuses like that is the theme of the whole movie. It's so great. Everyone should watch it.
Okay. Title?
Timeless Christmas.
Oh God. Okay.
I want to put it on my list. Thank you.
I guess she leaves him because
it's awful.
You know, he's doing his best to, you know, get, I guess, the, you know, money and career for their life. And she's like, this is not the priority that you should be having right now. That being said, like, it was the Victorian times and you didn't just, like, shack up with someone, especially if you're like, oh, I have to prove to your father or whatever. But obviously he hardens after that and he's not, like, that doesn't turn him around. That doesn't turn him around and make him change. He just
I guess, retreats into himself and hardens up. And Ariadne, I think in the actual book, he does actually visit her family in the dream and sees her, you know, telling her new husband and fat children, like, all about the man she almost married and how shit he was. So, yeah. Maybe that was a bit much for the Disney film.
Maybe. I mean, oh, sorry, go ahead. I think I would have loved to have seen that. And I think something that kind of gets lost here, but I think that is important in terms of that hardening up that you were mentioning, is like, we see him at school and he seems very sad to be alone. Like he's alone all the time. He doesn't have friends. And he obviously looks very sad. And then when Belle leaves him, there is an emphasis, more so in the song that she sings, but I think you can kind of get it from the way that the scene is, where he's left alone. And so I think that hardening comes from him choosing to be alone rather than being vulnerable to being left alone.
Well, yeah, do you think that's like a defense mechanism, though? Like he's been forced to be alone, therefore he's like,
I think so.
You know, screw you, I'm gonna harden up. You know, that's like a classic, you know, repressed character trait, isn't it?
Yeah. Like I won't have any expectations. I'm just gonna do it to myself, and this is how it's gonna be. Yeah, yeah.
But it's also about him like rejecting chances to change when the opening is there. You know,
sure. But then he kind of takes full advantage of those chances to change. I think when we get to the Ghost of Christmas Present, which I think this is my favorite section of the movie.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that is because of the songs that are in this section. Like I love Feels Like Christmas. And I love, the track is called like Christmas Scat, but it's the song between Bob Cratchit and Tiny Tim as they're walking home. Those two songs are very iconic for me and probably are the ones that Kendra was referring to as showing up in Christmas playlists. Love those ones. And I love the Ghost of Christmas Present, but Michael Caine, his Scrooge turns around pretty quickly into the Ghost of Christmas Present era. Quicker than I remembered him. I don't know if anyone had any thoughts about that or about this time period in general.
Yeah, I found it like quite jarring. It was like the Ghost of Christmas Present showed up and all of a sudden Michael Caine was like laughing like they were like bros from college or something. It was very weird. He just was like he's a
very likable giant, but yeah, no, I get you.
I guess he was just like that affected from the Ghost of Christmas Past that he had started to lighten up that much already. Could have been the case, but I did find it to be like quite an abrupt change in his attitude.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we talked about with Christmas Past, like you get these scenes of like him entering the memories and like thinking they're going to be good and then seeing them and being like, oh, that's really bad actually. Like the trauma of like kind of uncontrollably having this happy memory of like, oh, I loved my teacher. Oh, that was my friend. Oh, my old employer was so nice, and kind of uncontrollably getting this joy. And then the kind of stinger of each scene is like, but you were shit. Oh, sorry. And that kind of like emotional roller coaster and the ghost being like super creepy. He's, I guess, yeah, I feel like he's a little bit like not emotionally stable in the Christmas Present scenes, almost like that he's like been affected and now he's like been ripped open emotionally and he's like fully in it, like both with like getting swept up in the joy and then the trauma of the Cratchit family and stuff and being really hurt by the being really hurt by the nephew. So I also really like the Christmas Present scenes, but yeah, the emotional turnaround was kind of like pretty extreme. And you know, maybe he's just like on an emotional bender now or something. Like he's like, you know, the doors are ripped open and he's like ready to be receptive, I guess.
What did we feel about seeing the Cratchits as Kermit and Miss Piggy and their family? Like I love getting that time with them because they have very very animated personalities. And I also think it's just interesting of a sort of blended family of pigs and frogs.
That was one of my biggest questions coming in.
Yes.
How I was like, what are their kids going to be? But it made a sense. I was like, oh, of course, nothing. Like, what else would it be? Once I saw it, I was like, yeah, that makes total sense. I think Kermit is an excellent Bob Cratchit. He's like quintessential. I did know coming in that that Miss Piggy would be Mrs. Cratchit. And I was like, I'm not sure that's going to work. And still afterwards, I'm not sure it really works. But she is entertaining. I don't know if I can believe her being like a poor person because she's so like fabulous and flamboyant. But
just the thing about Piggy is like you can't make her play another role, really. Like it's like you can give her another name, but she's not an actor whose personality is going to adapt to another role.
So again, the 12-minute documentary, very revealing. So they, as well as interviews with like the creatives, they interview the Muppets. Like Gonzo has a line in there that's like, working with ghosts, they were all union. They came in very professional. And it's like, Piggy, when she's interviewed, it's like, I took this very small role. And normally I don't do that. And then like, even like the other characters are like, trying to get Piggy to play this character is like, it's impossible, but she did her best. Cause like they comment on a scene at the end where like, she's like ripping into Michael Caine being like, you should on Christmas. And she's just like, she went all in on that scene. You really felt her energy. And Kermit then has like, this is the last time I'll bring up this documentary, I swear.
No, it's great.
But Kermit has a line in the documentary where he's being interviewed and he's just like, I really just need to stress three things about this. We're not really married. Two, we're not really married. Three, we're not really married. Like he's like getting it out there. Like we're not a real couple. This was just, we're playing a couple, but we're not a couple. Just clearing the air here.
They are.
That's a whole nother discussion.
They are, aren't they? That's like the one thing I know as a child watching the Muppets that Kermit and Piggy are a couple. They're in love.
So, well, all right. If you watch
the Muppets, very abusive.
Yeah, if you watch the Muppets as an adult, you read the relationship very differently. So, like, they are. She is in love with him in the Muppet movie, like the original Muppet movie. It's a little bit more mutual, but then it like goes off the rails. Like it is like, this is like one of the most complicated relationships in all of like pairing.
Fiction.
Yeah. It's like, it's very complicated.
Okay. Fair enough.
But it's really funny.
It's hilarious.
So yeah, to comment on Piggy playing that role, it was a very much an inside joke as well to put Piggy as this character.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Like Piggy,
this is great.
Please play humble. And then even like the creators were like, she can't.
Oh my God. I mean, yeah, but who else would you get for that role?
Exactly.
There's no one else. And like Ariana said, like Kermit is quintessential Bob Cratchit. Like that is the best fit that would have ever been possible here. Hmm. So I guess had to have him or had to have her. But yeah, I really enjoyed the Ghost of Christmas Presents stuff. And it really provides a stark contrast for when we get into the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come, because that middle section is so colorful and has such a warmth to it, both in terms of like you see the family sitting at the table with the fire lit and all of that kind of stuff, and just all the colors are very warm. And then you get to Ghosts of Christmas Yet to Come and everything is shades of black and gray, and there's just a really eerie coldness that's seeping out of it. And I love the way they make that quick transition. And I have a really hard time judging whether or not the creepy child ghost is better or worse than the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come, because he terrified me as a child.
terrifies me.
Yeah.
Not a good look.
Not a good look. The proportions are weird on him. Like, he has very, very long arms and looks like a weird Dementor, Grim Reaper. Very scary. But so we kind of go through all of these terrible things that could happen to Scrooge, including all of these people laughing about the fact that he died and bargaining over his bed curtains, I think is what it was.
Yeah, like he looted his house and sold it to
the spider. Yeah. They sold it to the spider. And then you see like Tiny Tim is no longer with us. And I think that scene is very sad too. And again, you lose that sort of warmth there. So I'm not sure if I can ask if this section was enjoyable, because I don't know if it's meant to be, but I think it's effective. I think anybody kind of staring down their mortality would be affected by this, but I'm curious to hear thoughts about this ghost and what he shows Scrooge.
I do think this is probably one of the reasons why I didn't end up watching this movie as a child, is because I was so afraid of the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come from the Flintstones Christmas Carol. I just didn't want to put myself through that again. But specifically for the Tiny Tim scenes in this part and in the Ghost of Christmas Present, it's mentioned as well, where it's not really enjoyable. Like, I think it's so important, especially to Ariana's point earlier, Scrooge isn't necessarily just changing because he's afraid he's going to hell. Like, I think the Tiny Tim scene specifically is like, he's gaining perspective here and he's seeing how his actions have affected people. Like, he genuinely gains affection for Tiny Tim and is devastated that his actions might cause his death. And I think that's the one like main point of redemption for him. Like, he's not just changing because he's afraid that he's going to end up like the Marleys. Like, he doesn't want to hurt people in that way.
Yeah, and I think, like, kind of to that, Kendra, like, even when he first sees Cratchit's house in the present, he's, like, shocked. Like, he's like, they live here? Like, he didn't realize, basically, like, how far a dollar or a shilling goes. You know, like, he didn't, like... He kind of has no perspective on, like, you know, it's one banana, what could it possibly cost, $10, kind of, except, like, kind of the opposite of that. Like, you know, it's $600, that's all you need, right? Like, kind of, like, he genuinely doesn't, like, have the perspective of, like, how poor people are and, like, how their circumstances are. Like, he maybe thinks himself is, like, not wealthy. Like, he might not even see himself as like particularly wealthy because he doesn't like live in a lavish way, and like we don't like know exactly like how much money he's bringing in, especially because like he's like a money lender. Like, he might not actually have like, which is like a dodgy profession full stop, but he might not have like literally that much income like himself, but like he doesn't realize like what he has compared to the Cratchits, for example. Because, yeah, he's really shocked, like, that this is the level of poverty and struggle that they have. And that, and I'm like, I mean, again, like, I appreciate, like, not having a lot of tolerance for people who aren't aware of that kind of thing. But, like, no, this is a Victorian classic, presumably to tell middle class or rich people how well off they are and how they should give back, you know, like, to, like, the readers reading it, you know, to actually onboard this message. Yeah, I mean, I don't think his change is purely, like, I don't want to go to hell either. And, I mean, Kane's very emotional about it, obviously, so that helps.
But I guess to that point, does this, like, is this an effective storytelling mechanism to get outside people to change, or does everyone just put themselves in Cratchit's position? Does no one make themselves the Scrooge? Like, can everyone just put themselves below someone else?
Yeah.
And be like, I'm the lower on the totem pole here. Everyone else needs to change.
That's a very valid question. I don't know what the actual impact of it was at the time when the book was published, but in general about society and about moral storytelling, you know, and Ariana mentioned it before, that people, you know, watch these stories and they don't realize that they're the villain. I mean, that's a huge issue in general. I don't know. Does anyone have any like profound thoughts about that?
No, I think it's a great point, because I'm trying to think, you know, like where the everyman is Kermit, like in the essence of whether you're watching the Muppets or not, like you want to align yourself with Kermit no matter what role he's playing. So to have him be Bob Cratchit, you're like, of course, watching this, you want to relate to Kermit. So anyone going in is not immediately going to be like, I'm the person who's in contrast to this beloved figure in general. And then to narrow it down specifically to the story, it's like, oh yeah, no, I'm definitely in Kermit's position. I'm being taken advantage of. I'm asking for so little when, you know, the other people are like hammering me down and not realizing what you have. So yeah, I think it's a very good question. And, you know, I think having just that character in general is, I don't know, again, like you were saying, that, you know, what the impact was then, but like even now, like, you know, like to Adriana's point earlier, like these people are going home and they're watching It's a Wonderful Life and all of these Christmas movies with their family, and they're not sitting there going like, ooh, yeah, maybe
I am
not just giving them $600.
Yeah.
Like, let me reopen the congressional session because these people need more money. They're just sitting there being like, that was nice that Bob got to see his kid one last time. Like, you know, it's like, really, the message isn't hitting home because they're not putting themselves in that position.
Right. Because people don't normally see themselves as being on top. There's an interesting conversation, I think, going on just kind of in general right now. And my roommate has sent me an article on this, but like, the idea of us living, at least kind of stateside, living in a sort of caste system without noticing it. And I think that very much plays into the idea that we're talking about here, where everybody thinks that they are maybe lower and less privileged on the system than they actually are. And so taking the woe is me angle rather than how can I help using what I have.
Yeah. I mean,
so if you don't acknowledge it, I don't think you can take action on it.
In general, in nearly every circumstance in life, financial, intelligence, success, anything, most people consider themselves like the center of the bell curve. Like they don't think, you know, even if someone was like super smart or like super dumb, they're like, you know, I'm average. Everyone thinks they're the average, like the middle of the spectrum, usually. Like that they, I mean, some people might think that they're really high or really low, but in general, people don't have like a very good perspective and like, you know, wealth and I guess, you know, self-sufficiency would also come into that. But everyone tends to think that they are the center of a scale rather than like overly privileged or something like that. So that definitely could be a factor. And I mean, I've just seen this on the Wikipedia as well, and it's sort of a more concise version of what I was saying, which is to say Dickens wrote A Christmas Carol in response to British social attitudes towards poverty, particularly child poverty, and wished to use the novella as a means to put forward his arguments against it. The story shows Scrooge as a paradigm for self-interest and the possible repercussions of ignoring the poor, especially children in poverty, personified by the allegorical figures of want and ignorance, who are like two extra ghosty bits that aren't in this movie. The two figures were created to arouse sympathy with readers, as was Tiny Tim. Douglas Fairhurst, a scholar, observes the use of such figures allowed Dickens to present his message of the need for charity without alienating his largely middle-class readership. What it doesn't say, and I'm sure I could find answers about it, is whether this, like, had a knock-on effect at all. Like for example, like another example is, like, the novel Black Beauty was written as the author's objection to, like, animal rights issues, like abuse of animals and, like, especially working animals. And that book actually did change public sympathy and like was actually like a knock-on effect in getting certain laws about animal cruelty changed. And I do not know the impact of A Christmas Carol in terms of it actually changing the way people act, aside from maybe like more generosity on Christmas, because it also had the impact of like heightening like Christmas traditions in the UK. Like Christmas was like really up and down in the UK about whether it was like celebrated. Like a lot of the customs that came to Christmas were only like in the Victorian era. In it was always like kind of a thing, but like not as big a thing as it is. And this book did cement like some traditions as kind of like a thing that you do. And the charitable giving was a part of that, even though I'm sure all of these people who went to church were encouraged to do that anyway. But I don't know the knock-on effect, but it was certainly the intention. And I assume that Charles Dickens must have been really angry if, like, Mike Pence was reading this and thinking of himself as Bob Cratchit, you know? Like, I assume that would have created more anger if it didn't actually have a knock-on effect.
I think that might be the problem in making Scrooge such a caricature. Like, he's the worst possible part of, like, all of these people. He's the farthest on the spectrum in every point. So, like, it's so easy to put yourself below him. So it probably would have been much more effective to make him kind of more of a relatable person, but
yeah, like trick the people into it, like, you know, like, yeah, you know have them follow along with him and then twist. So yeah,
that in mind, how does the ending hold up? Because the ending is kind of like the Ghost of Christmas Present section with all the joy but none of the sadness or like criticism. It's like one good thing after another. Scrooge is basically making it rain pretty hardcore. And so I think for me, because I came to this in the same way that I have over the years with just like the way that I saw it as a kid, like it flowed perfectly for me. But I think I need to rewatch it with our conversation in mind. But I'm just curious how this ending either holds up for you, Brittany, or held up for anybody coming to this brand new.
Just seeing in the doc here, the line, "I will honor Christmas and try to keep it all year." I think that's something that's very relatable, because I think just in general, Christmas is a time of extra generosity for our society. So the idea of bringing that into the rest of the year is nice to think about and to try to hold. So that part, I think, carries really well.
We're getting very deep here, but I'm a really big fan of Muppets running, and a lot of Muppets run at the end. And so I'm very distracted watching the ending of this, because all the Muppets are like, flop, 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 flop.
Oh my God, Bean Bunny. Bunny is my favorite.
I have a hard time narrowing down on the prominent messaging of the movie. But yeah, I think, you know, everything we've been saying is sort of rings true. You know, he gets like, there's the scene with Beaker where he gives him the scarf, and there's that like literal sign of life on like this very like dark coated
black man. Yeah.
So like, you know, it's very joyous. And I think he does, like, he's probably going to have a heart attack later when he thinks about how much money he just spent, because I don't think money issues really clear up that quickly in a person. But yeah, I mean, it's like, it's very nice to see. And like, you know, there's still people who are very terrified of him, and to have him just like push through that is like nice. But, you know, he takes it in stride when people come at him. But yeah, like I said, I think floppiness of the Muppets really just does one on me. So I'll try to rewatch the ending in light of our conversation again without the Muppets running.
On another not really serious note, watching the ending, I was like, I feel really bad for Miss Piggy. he just invited all of these strangers into her house on Christmas. I was like, Scrooge, invite the strangers to your house.
Your house. What are you doing? Yeah.
She's going to have to clean up after them.
Yeah.
And most likely cook that turkey, that really big turkey that they kept saying how big it was.
I don't eat turkey, but I thought that you have to cook your turkey for like a day and
minimum a few hours. They're those not going to be eating for a while.
they're going to die of salmonella.
They're all going to eat their chestnuts.
Yeah, they're going to have to share the chestnuts.
That's a great call, Ariana. That bothers me a little bit now too. Oh man. Well, because now that we're kind of talking about the silly elements and kind of the Muppetness of it all, I know we're kind of running a little bit of a long episode, but I do want to get into the Muppetness of all of this. So we talked about Miss Piggy and her role. We talked about how Kermit is kind of the quintessential Bob Cratchit. Are there any other Muppets that anyone wants to call out as having like a really good role, or a Muppet that maybe you wanted to see more of and that didn't have a substantial role here?
I personally am not that familiar with like the Muppet tropes. I liked Gonzo and Rizzo and was not really aware of their like place in the Muppet canon. I know Gonzo is like the lead of quite a few of the movies as opposed to like Kermit. I don't really know like his deal, but I enjoyed him a lot in this. And Rizzo, I thought Rizzo was like a villain, and he's not apparently. So
yeah, Rizzo is harmless.
I liked them together. I assume the Fozzie and Mom was like a joke that I don't understand. Like I assume that his mother is like a factor of Muppet life that I don't understand. Because obviously that, you know, it's a twist on whatever it was in the book. But, I don't know. Brittany, do you think there was anyone, like, particularly underused or anything like that?
I don't think anyone was underused. I think everyone was used without, like, you know, they hit on what they're known for. And then it's sort of like as, like, a wink and a nudge. So, like, Ralph doesn't have any lines, but you see him at the piano, at the thing. You know, they gave Animal like two really great bits. I think Rizzo and Gonzo are perfect in their roles. I think that they play just so well, like Rizzo, like constantly wanting to eat. And then like when Gonzo just gets so exasperated with him and then Rizzo kisses his beak, I just,
I forgot to say that was my favorite. I didn't write it in, but that was,
I'm sorry. Was I did look beforehand.
No, it's fine.
But they're like, their energy together is just so great. And Gonzo is my dad's favorite because Gonzo's a plumber, in case everyone didn't know this. Gonzo was a plumber when they met him, and my dad's a pipe fitter. So like one and the same. But so Gonzo is like a huge hit in our house. And being Dickens is just, I think, perfect.
There was a joke of his that I didn't massively understand where Rizzo was like, you enjoyed that, didn't you? And Gonzo was like, yeah. Is it like, does Gonzo have like a trope of like being blown up or thrown out of things?
Yes, he gets thrown out of, yeah. So he's like, he does like all that kind of like daredevil-y stuff. But he also, there's a great Gonzo like nod where a chicken is walking into the party and Gonzo's like, oh, does he Camilla the chicken is like his
Leo was like, what it like, he's got a thing with chickens, and I'm like, okay. She noticed that, and I was like, I don't understand that.
He just like the chicken walks by and he's like, oh, and I'm like, oh my god. I wrote a lot of them down, especially just like, you know, in terms of just like things that people do, like Rizzo, like when he's getting chased around the thing, he yells like, I'm from New Jersey, which is like, that's in Muppets Take Manhattan. You learn that about him. But like, yeah, it's just like all sorts of little things that are so good. And like, just in terms of like characters I wish I saw more of, probably, I mean, I want to see Beaker in every single scene of every single thing all the time. But he was used, they were all used very well. I think the rats were used the most effectively. They're very good in Muppets Take Manhattan. I think that they don't have like a lot of like speaking roles, but they like work the kitchen. And but in this movie, I think that they are just, they are so funny. So, so funny.
Yeah, that from New Jersey thing, I've never really noticed in Muppets things before, but like, it's like the Muppets kind of keep going after the scene moves to a new scene. Like, mm-hmm. they keep saying stuff. It's so funny. Do they do that in every Muppets thing?
Yeah, so like, even like after, like, you guys just have to like watch Muppet bloopers from anything. It doesn't matter what it's from, but like, anytime they call cut, they stay in character. So like, they'll just like keep talking and be like, oh, that take was horrible. But they're like in character and still moving the Muppets. Like,
as yeah, as if they were actors, yes. As if the Muppets were people.
So like, a lot of stuff is ad-libbed in like a lot of, like, not, the script is the script, but like a lot of like the jokes are ad-libbed.
Yeah. I mean, obviously this had tons of anachronistic jokes, like, you know, the Sam the Eagle American thing and like, you know, stuff that wasn't time. It wasn't like a very serious time appropriate adaptation. Like, yeah, lots of Easter eggs and like not quite fourth wall breaking, but like, yeah, humorous anachronisms is common in comedy adaptations of classic things. But there were a few good ones in this that I liked even without really knowing like Muppet lore. So
yeah. And I think, like we were saying, like kind of at the top of the episode, just having Michael Caine play it so straight, like so, yeah. so straight, like never once being like, this is ridiculous, and having everybody else sort of like go off the deep end. Oh, I remembered the other one. Hold on. I want to make sure no one else said it because it was one of my favorite things that I don't think I've ever caught before.
I had that a lot this time around.
Yeah.
Like trying to sit and look for stuff.
Yeah, so no one took this, but it's right at the beginning where they're singing and they're like going through the town.
The Scrooge song.
Yeah, and one of the fruits on the fruit stand yells, "I'm being stolen."
Is that like
No, because it's the talking fruit, so it's telling its vendor that it's being stolen.
Yeah, I mean, the talking fruit was just like very disturbing to me in terms of like, you're gonna eat that and it's sentient. There was a bit in the when they were in the Scrooge's office where they're talking about being cold, and one of the rats is like, "Our assets are frozen," and I was like,
"Well, then like Rizzo even says later to your fruit point, he's like, I don't eat the talking fruit."
Yeah,
yeah. I think Rizzo had some of the best lines of the whole movie. So I echo the fact that like Rizzo and Gonzo were the best characters. I also loved Bean Bunny, but I love the mice.
Oh, I love the mice as well. I love the mice. They were very cute.
They made me very happy. They get a nice big wedge of cheese.
Yeah. I was like, when they kept going on and Scrooge was giving stuff out, but I'm like, the mice need the cheese. And then he did it and I was happy. But yeah, Statler and Waldorf, as you've wrote, Danielle, as Jacob and Robert Marley, as opposed to just Jacob Marley, that Marley was dead, was interesting. Like, their attitude was like, in the book, Marley is not as proud of himself as Statler and Waldorf were in the film. I'll say that.
Yeah, I didn't write that one, actually.
But oh, man, Brittany or was that Ariana?
Not sure, but they do have a good attitude when they're just singing in chains
and like laughing off all the horrible things they did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
no, that was perfect casting for there too.
Yeah, I mean, did anyone have any comments about like the songs or anything, like a fave song or a song that you really hated, or like what you just said about the deleted scene?
So my VHS growing up very much had the apparently deleted musical sequence When Love Is Gone. And I actually didn't notice it was missing until watching this movie on Disney Plus last year.
Apparently, like, they've been trying to find like a good copy, like an original print to instate it. Like, there's versions people taped off their old VHS, but they want like the original film part to reinstated into the film at the same quality that the rest of the film is at, if that makes sense. And they can't find it. They've been told it exists, we'll find it eventually, but it currently is apparently not
So they, I think there's something more recent than this one. They actually did find it. So for context of what we're talking about, is in the breakup scene with Scrooge and with Belle, there is a moment where he tells her, "I love you." She looks at him and says, "You did once," and then gets up and walks away. And it's very abrupt. And the reason why it's very abrupt is because there's actually supposed to be another musical number in there. It's in between her standing up and then seeing Rizzo and Gonzo crying as she walks away. In the middle of there is a song called "When Love Is Gone." And it's basically her saying that sometimes love just doesn't work out. Sometimes these things happen and people grow apart. There's a line in this song that I absolutely love and I remember belting out as a kid, and it's just, it was almost love. It was almost always. And like, just like the hinging on the almost. It's a beautiful song, but the reason why it was cut out was because filmmakers didn't think it connected with kids a lot, which maybe I was an anomaly. I don't know.
There were no Muppets in the scene.
And there were no Muppets in the scene. That's a good point. You know what? I didn't even think about it. But yeah, Rizzo and Gonzo are just kind of standing on the side. They're not doing anything. So yeah. So they cut it out. And I guess now that the movie was being put on Disney Plus, a lot of people who, like me, grew up with the VHS noticed that it was missing. And yeah, that article that Natalie has and that we will share basically kind of gives the rundown of them looking for this. And I believe they said that they found it.
Yeah, so the article I linked
copies moving forward. But they need to figure out a way to digitize it and put it on Disney Plus. And
apparently, that'll be in the rusher. Yeah, there was another article in like 2018 where the son, what's his face, Brian Henson, was like, We keep looking. We can't find it. Disney lost the negative, made the movie with it in, and the studio wanted it released. And there was an agreement that, you know, they wanted it out of the movie version and agreement that they'd put it back in for the video release, but didn't. They made a video master of it, you know, had the negative, and in the process they lost the video master. And apparently he's like, I call them every month to be like, have you found it yet? And he funded a team to specifically try and find it. And then this year, apparently he got called as a surprise. He was like told, hey, we're remastering for VHS. We're remastering for 4K for streaming. You check the new version and tell us if it's okay. And they'd found it and put it back in as a surprise. But apparently that version isn't yet available to see. So that's not released yet, but they did find it and reinstate it and like shared that with Brian Henson as a surprise. And it's all, it is coming back.
Poor Brian, man. He was 28 when he made this movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
But like, you know, the Muppet Gang was there, so it was like fine. It was like working with a bunch of people, but he directed it. 28. I was like, oh my God, what was I doing? 28. Only 2 years
left. Apparently the people they had some, you know, some, there's definitely a few like older movies that are like quite intense production, like Nightmare Before Christmas, like when the people when they made Nightmare Before Christmas, all of the creatives involved in that were like 25 to 30, like doing that. They all put that together as like ingenious young people, and it's like, oh God. But interesting. Yeah, so that's that song.
Yeah, that's that song. Does anyone have any other thoughts about the other musical numbers or anything about this movie that we have not yet covered?
I liked the Scrooge song, the opening number. I thought that was like legitimately a number that could hold up in like musical theater. I like the tone of it, like something about it, like the, yeah, just the structure of that song I really liked. And so, yeah, I got on board with the musical element pretty fast, even though I wasn't expecting it.
The bell song, or like the village song in Beauty and the Beast, just like the dour version of it.
Well, yeah, it's a trope. Like musical theatre songs have certain tropes about, like, you know, what, you know, the introduction, like, song or the setup song. And this is a great setup song. Like, it's really well-written setup song. So,
yeah. And the rest of the songs don't, like, veer from that. Like, that's, like, the level that you're going to get the whole movie. It's not like one song is, like, a showstopper. It's like, no, this is the tone and we're going to ride it all the way to the end.
And it's and that one in particular for me, it was a storytelling song. Like, there are details. It's not just like, I've told you everything I need to know in the dialogue and now I'm just going to step aside and sing a song. The song has storytelling in it, which is, again, how musical theater songs should be. Like, you can't tune out the songs. The story is in the songs. And so, yeah, I don't know. Is this something like, could they do this live, Brittany? I mean, maybe not with Michael Caine, but, like, can Muppets perform live?
I mean, yeah, it would be a little complicated staging. I mean, they'd figure it out. They could.
Yeah.
They could do it. I mean, like, the puppeteers in the Marley and Marley were physically in the shot, but they were just wearing all black. It was just easy to hide them.
But yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, it's like one of those suspension of disbelief things. Like, you know, you can put the puppeteers under the stage, or you could put them in behind the back things
or something. Yeah,
yeah, like, you know that they're there.
Or horse, you know. Yeah. Like,
so, like, when you're watching them, like, you are really watching the puppets.
For sure. If you got a live version, so now I'm just going to veer off. If Broadway was like, we're going to do a live Muppets Christmas Carol, and it wasn't Michael Caine, who would you like to play Scrooge in current contemporary life?
The bigger question, the question is not Michael Caine, it's who's voicing Kermit, which is a huge problem in the Muppet community right now, because the new voice of Kermit is not good. It's not Michael Caine. The Scrooge, I could take it or leave it. Whoever wants to play him can play him, as long as it's not James Corden.
God.
Anyone but James Corden, I'm open to. But yeah, I would have much bigger concerns on the Muppet voice acting than I would on this movie.
Kermit was Jim Henson, but he wasn't in this movie. So why has he got such a bad voice actor now, but this old one was acceptable? It wasn't Jim Henson.
So Steve Whitmire was also not well received at the start. So, because Steve's voice you kind of get used to because he's in a lot of the later films, but this is, like, real deep Muppet lore.
Go for it. We're here for Muppet. Muppet drill. Your Muppet knowledge.
So Jim Henson never made Kermit smile that much, and Steve started opening Kermit up to be a little bit too expressive. So the Kermit that's all, he is a little too giddy. But his voice is fine, but it is very different. Like, if you were to watch the original Muppet movie and then watch this, like, back to back, you would notice it. But it's not, if you're, like, just used to hearing, like, Kermit the Frog here, like, that you really probably couldn't tell any of them apart. But so when Steve took over, it was sort of like he had trained under Jim, and Steve's also Rizzo, and he had been doing Rizzo for, like, 11, 12 years or something like that. And then, so he did Rizzo and Kermit in the movie. It was sort of like, okay, they wanted him to do it. I think he was doing some publicity, like, at the time before Jim died. So, like, if Jim couldn't physically be somewhere to do Kermit, like, they would send Steve. So he had experience. I don't know. He also was, like, very much, like, when he took over the role, was like, I don't know, man. Like, I don't think this is going to work. But then we had Kermit for a long time, and now we have a new Kermit. I don't know how to describe it without it sounding weird. It's a little, like, pitchy. I know it's a Muppet voice, but it just sounds so, like, he did Kermit through, like, the reboot of the Muppet Show on ABC, which I loved and no one else in America did. It's a very, like, weird tone that Kermit has, and I think watching him play that Kermit, that was his, like, first big role as Kermit. And hearing that Kermit in the way that they were writing that show just, like, did not sit well.
We're going very over time, but I did want to say that I have seen that reboot TV show, and I really enjoyed it. But it is a very weird show in that they, like, changed, I believe they changed showrunners, like, halfway through.
Yeah.
Because, like, the first half is, like, they tried to make it, like, edgy, and then they realized nobody wants edgy Muppets. That's stupid.
And then they got silly in the second half, which was like, fine, that's great. It was much better show, but they tried to make it too much like the Muppet Show, like the original Muppet Show. And then they were like, oh, but we'll make it like The Office. And then like, that did not work. Like that's, we're not, I'm not here to see that.
Anyway, fair enough.
Yeah.
One more fun fact. I'm so sorry, but
no, please do.
Rita Moreno won her Emmy for being on the Muppet Show. And I do have, it's like a two minute clip that won her Emmy, but it is very, very funny. Like the funniest 2 minutes you'll ever see. So go watch it.
I will have to watch that and the making of the 12-minute behind the scenes after this, after we hang up here.
Yeah, thank you for that insight, Brittany. I'm genuinely fascinated. I like to hear you talk about the Muppets.
I do too. I hope we have another opportunity at some point to talk about them with you. Thank you for your knowledge. All right, let's leave it there because as I feel like we could probably talk about this all day and all night. I know Brittany can, but let's get into our favorite scenes and our favorite lines. In terms of favorite scenes, mine is very specifically Michael Caine dancing awkwardly in the Feels Like Christmas musical number. He starts dancing really towards the end and it's like half robot, but like half
it's like penguin
shaking back and forth.
Yeah.
It's very boxy and just very entertaining. So that is my favorite scene. Kendra, what is your favorite scene?
My favorite scene was Beaker giving Scrooge the scarf, mostly because I just loved Beaker as the donation collector. And I loved that he got a little sweet moment. It really had nothing to do with Scrooge. I was just happy to see Beaker have that time.
And his little scarf.
Yeah, it was perfect.
It's so cute. That's a good one. Thank you. And speaking of cute character moments, Ariana, your favorite scene?
Mine was when Animal shows up, even though he didn't really do that much, but he's my favorite. And he's very adorable.
He is very adorable. Natalie, your favorite scene?
Yeah, Brittany mentioned it, but it was when Gonzo was being like done with Rizzo, and Rizzo is just like, kiss, to charm him into being happy with him again. It was just very random and cute. Yeah, I just, in terms of like just little moments, that was very adorable.
And then there's Brittany and your favorite scene, which I also loved very, very much.
This is my favorite scene. Every single time I watch it, I laugh so hard. I have to rewind it and watch it again.
Yep.
And it's when they're asking for coal, like an extra scoop of coal, because it's cold.
Uh-huh.
He's just like, you know, well, how would it feel? How cold would it feel in the unemployment line? And it cuts back to the rats and they're all dressed in like hula outfits and they're like, he's rich.
This is an island in the sun.
Gosh, it's so
funny.
It's just, it's my sense of humor embodied in the scene. I love it.
Wow.
When take like this in the same like scene, the rats just like crack me up. Anytime their little quills are moving, hilarious. But then also like when they get this big stack of papers and they're like, they keep going back and forth in the background. It's just, it's so great.
I definitely think they steal a lot of this movie. They're so good. So thank you. All right, favorite lines. My favorite line is actually a short exchange between Rizzo and Charles Dickens, where I forgot what it's after, but Rizzo asks, should we be worried about the kids in the audience? And Dickens goes, nah, this is culture.
After the Marley, like after the Marley ghost song, like, this is getting dark kind of situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like they keep like saying that they're dead. And then they're like, well, what about the kids in the audience? And then he whispers and he's like, it's for dramatic effect.
And like, I think this stuck out to me this time because there are so many things that like should be traumatizing or even like that today would not be okay for kids, but anything that's considered like culture or literature somehow always passes that litmus test. And so this line made me laugh, as well as like Brittany and like the kind of heat wave. Mm. One of the lines I always remember from this movie is "light the lamp, not the rat." Light the lamp, not the rat. And so that is also a favorite line.
I almost put that because that was like the one line that I feel like I knew. Like maybe I've seen a clip or something or like a meme. But I've definitely, that I was like, I know this joke. So yeah.
Yeah. So it's a good one. And Kendra, yours is also a good one. What is your favorite line?
There was a line that made me laugh really hard in the opening number and nothing really beat it. And it was just when the mice said, "No cheeses for us Mises."
<It's very> Yeah.
adorable. Adorable. Mm-hmm. Ariana, your favorite line?
Mine was when Rizzo says, "I'm creating scarcity. It drives the prices up."
Natalie, your favorite line?
Mine was kind of like the gag where they're trying to get over the fence. Again, it's kind of a like scene slash line combo, but they're trying to get over the fence, and then, you know, there's this whole performance of boosting them up on the fence, and then Rizzo forgot his jelly beans and he just goes through the bars, and Gonzo's like, "You can fit through those bars," and he's like, "Yeah." It's just like that kind of gag. Like Brittany said her heat wave was that kind of gag is gets her. This kind of gag really gets me. But I'm not usually susceptible to puns, but my other favorite line was when Kane and the jolly Christmas present spirit were meeting, and he's being like repetitive, and he says, Scrooge says, "You're a little absent-minded spirit." And he goes, "No, I'm a large absent-minded spirit." And I cannot tell you how much like puns usually don't get me. And I don't usually like actually laugh at them. I can sometimes be like, "That's clever," but this, it got me for some reason. It was very funny to me.
And Brittany, you have our last favorite line of the evening.
So this is a gif I use all of the time, and it's when Gonzo takes Rizzo and uses him to clear the window, and Rizzo's just like, "Thank you for making me a part of this."
I wrote that one down too. It's so funny. He has all the best lines, I think, in this movie. So those are our favorite scenes, favorite lines, thoughts about this movie, thoughts about Christmas Carol in general. But we want to hear what you have to say. We want to hear your favorites and everything that you think about A Muppet's Christmas Carol. So please email us at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. Tweet at us at re_watchable, especially if you want GIFs sent back to you. I'm sure that's probably how Brittany would handle any sort of tweets about this movie. And you can also join our Facebook group and come talk to us there. We're at Rewatchables Rewinders. We haven't been as talkative as of late, but we would love to turn that around. So come find us. And after all of that, if you would be so kind as to rate us 5 stars on iTunes, then Karen will bring you some figgy pudding. And I feel like that would be a great way to end this year. Please do so. It helps other people find us. And so that we can keep doing what we're doing. What we're doing, we're still not sure, but we do like podcasting together. We definitely will be back at some point. But we wanted to give you this Christmas gift, and we wanted to reunite for this. So thank you so much for listening, and thank you for helping us get through 2020. We hope you have a great holiday season, and we will talk to you soon. So until then, I'm Danielle.
I'm Kendra.
I'm Ariana.
I'm Natalie.
And I'm Brittany.
Talk to you later. Bye.
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 Oh my God, I cannot believe I didn't talk about the Kermit controversy. I completely blanked on it.
Ugh. What do you mean?
So Disney fired Steve Whitmer.
I thought that's what happened. And I was waiting to see if you said something. And then I thought I was wrong.
I was like, no, he's not. I was like, no, there's no way he's dead. I'm like, that's not why he left. And then like, I couldn't like get my brain to like fire synapses fast enough to like get me back to like why. And I was like,
but they like, fired him after 25 years. Like,
so I was like, what is going on? But yeah, he's fine, but he was fired for caring too much.
Oh my gosh. Why was he like this? Was stupid and
no, so
Kermit
like,
would never act like this.
No, he was. So like in interviews, they would like ask him to do stuff and he's like, no, Kermit wouldn't do that. And Disney was not liking the direction that he was very like against a lot of the stuff that they wanted him to do.
Who owned, because like,
it's so weird. I think you should keep this segment and put it as like an after credits moment.
Like, oh my God, I can't believe I didn't talk about
this. Exactly.
I think you literally should because it's interesting. But holy crap, that's so weird.